If you're trying to figure out how to navigate the tricky tightrope of parenting while you have questions, doubts, and wonderings about your spiritual journey, our podcast is for you.
It doesn't matter if your kids are smalls, middles, or bigs. We'll explore what and how we're deconstructing from churchianity, harmful belief systems, and diving deep into the ways we can work this out in parenthood.
We're also going to work through ideas for reconstructing a space for our families to thrive under new systems of love and freedom.
We can't wait to bring you some hope that you're not alone and that it's really okay, even good, to explore all the possibilities that may have felt closed off in the past.
Our podcast is going to offer you grace and space to be exactly where you are and who you are.
We're really glad you're here, and we're excited for today's episode. Listen in.
God is like a fort, strong and secure, with walls that are mighty and safe. Inside, there are hidden places to hold you when you're scared or need a quiet place to rest. That quote is from the children's book, What is God Like?, with Matthew Paul Turner and Rachel Held Evans.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Deconstructing Mamas podcast. We're talking with Matthew Paul Turner today, New York Times bestselling children's author and dad of three. We're so excited to have you here, Matthew. Thanks for making time for us.
I've looked forward to this. I mean, I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
Yay. Okay. Well, before we get into some of the deeper stuff, can you tell us a little bit about what your day looks like, what your family looks like for those who might not know, and what makes your heart come alive?
Well, that is a mouthful, okay? Like, that is a whole lot. I have three kids. I have a 15-year-old, a 12-year-old, and a 9.5-year-old. And they are all at school now. They live with me 3 days of the week, and they live with their mom 4 days a week. And I see them every day. I feel like they're here every single day. So as a writer, I am mostly just either tapping on my phone or tapping on to a laptop. Believe it or not, I write a good bit with my phone now just because I write children's books. You know, it's not like it's a long, you know, essay type thing that I'm writing most of the time. And so I do a lot of my children's book writing on my phone. And what brings my heart alive? I took an art class last year. That was a gift from my ex-wife, Jessica, gave me an art class for Father's Day. And it was basically a mixed media experience where I started creating art with paper, paint, and a whole bunch of other things. And also, it actually helps to be creative in another medium or using another area. It helps me be creative in the moment for my writing as well, because it's kind of like a palate cleanser for my brain or my heart. And so it just allows my thought process to be a little freer in the moment. And yet it keeps me in the zone, you know, because like being able to go in and out of that zone is really helpful. And having another creative outlet really is helpful in that process for me.
Well, Matthew, if you had to describe your faith background in one word, what would it be and why?
Trauma. And I wouldn't have described it in any way, shape, or form like that growing up in it, but it was, I mean, I tell this story way too often, but I had Barbies burned in front of me to explain hell as a kid and like that kind of thing in second grade. So I went to a church that was so far outside of the norm. And when I was 4 years old, my parents helped start a brand new church experience in my hometown. I was raised in Maryland, where most people are either Catholic or Methodist. And I was independent fundamental Baptist. And I went to the school that was associated with the church. And so it was like my whole life completely got turned upside down and changed. Now, growing up, I would have like thought that that was like a wonderful thing and absolutely the very best thing for me, except the fact that I went to school with anxiety every single day. And I was scared of my teachers and scared of like getting caught and being, you know, my parents finding out I did something wrong. It was just constant stress. And so there were small traumas all the time. Like, it's rare that I remember a peaceful time when it came to church. My mom and dad were both very involved. Like, my dad was constantly having to go to deacons meetings and there being some major decision that was stressing him out. And it usually involved some other person or some other family or somebody that their life was going to change because of a vote that my dad made or didn't make, kind of thing. And it was just constant. And so I was in that particular church experience for 14 years. And it definitely, it had all the awful things that churches of that kind had in the 80s and 90s. So,
wow, you're actually the second person this season, along with Amber from Fundy Freed, that grew up a part of the IFB. I don't know that particular denomination very well. Can you tell us more about it?
Well, what people don't realize is that in the 80s, it boasted most of the mega churches. Mm-hmm. Like, it was some of the very biggest churches in America during the 1980s. Like, my church was by far, I grew up in a small town on the eastern shore of Maryland. I was 7 miles from Baltimore, but it took an hour and a half to get there because of the Chesapeake Bay. While it was a peninsula, the eastern shore has a little bit of an island mentality that we're about 10 or 15 years behind everybody else. And so if they had 100 people come to their church, they were considered a big church. And there was a time, I mean, for a season, we had like 1,000 people come into our church from all across the eastern shore. And so we were a large church. We were well known in that area after a while. Many of the churches that were IFB in the 80s, like the big ones, like some had 5,000-6,000 people that they do on Sunday. And they were also really well known for bus ministry, which I don't know if you're familiar with bus ministry, where they would basically buy a whole bunch of buses and they would travel all across the area, pick up kids from who knows where and bring them to church and then take them back to their homes on the afternoon after church.
Oh, and all their parents were happy that their kids were being taken care of and going to church, right?
Yeah, that was a selling point mm-hmm. because they would be bus visiting on Saturdays, and you know, where they would encourage everybody, hey, just remember, I'm going to be here. Make sure you're that, you know, ready to go to church on Sunday morning. It's embarrassing to even mention this, but like my church, for a period of time, probably 2 or 3 years, the church kids were not considered the same as the bus kids. Okay. And they segregated the experiences that we had during that time. And for the most part, it was down racial lines. Now, it was wasn't perfectly down racial lines, but for the most part, it was a racial segregation in the mid-80s, that because they were afraid the church kids would be influenced by the bus kids.
My God.
You spoke earlier about burning Barbies to make a point about hell. That feels like so out there to me. Was this a one-off or was it part of like a bigger agenda? What did it represent for them?
They only burned a Barbie one time because it was like it hit the news, like the local newspaper talked about it and all that. But there was always this weird illustration that would, like, I remember a guy one time like asking us, who do you think your worst enemy is? And, you know, of course, we're Baptists. And so we're raising our hand and we're saying Satan. And, you know, and we know like 100 names for Satan. So we're all like raising our hands and we're all wrong. And so he ended up picking a paper bag out and he pulls out a mirror and he pans the mirror across in front of us and says, you are your worst enemy.
My God.
Those kinds of moments, like it was a cluster. You know, I mean, churches did a whole bunch of weird stuff. Like, you know, hey, if we have 100 people come to church for the first time on a Sunday, the youth pastor is going to jump off the Chester River Bridge, things
yes.
like that. Like, you know, it's like all these like gimmicks to get people in the pew. And every Sunday, you know, like we would boast about how many people got saved and how many people got baptized. And the majority of those people were kids that came on buses, where their parents weren't involved or they weren't involved in the situation or the story or them making that choice to make a decision for Jesus. And so like, this was my entire life. This wasn't when we started the school became the place where everything that the church preached was mandated by people who were not trained to work with children. Like a majority of my teachers were not educated in a way that most teachers were educated. And so not only did they not necessarily know the material and were relying on just like everyday knowledge to get them through, they had no training in interacting with kids. And so you give a whole bunch of religious rules to people who are not trained to work with kids and tell them that those, that class of kids has to follow all these rules. I mean, it is a terrible situation because the unkindness, the anger, like, I mean, I saw teachers physically push kids up against walls. The things that happened in that school at that particular time, like, I mean, I'm dumbfounded by it now. It was all normal. It was just my life.
Right.
And, you know, we were a small school, so we all knew. We only had 120 kids in the whole school from K through 12. So, I mean, I graduated in a class of four. And if something was happening in the first grade room and I'm in ninth grade, we knew about it. Like it was,
yeah,
we were all together.
Well, you're talking about like how big, right, like this church was at that time. And then we wonder like why everyone has all this trauma, right? Like why everyone has this trauma, like no one's come back in their body. Like if this is like what we're leading with, right? Like,
yeah.
I mean, it's unbelievable. I, at least twice at summer camp, for me, they did this like pull the fish out of water. Like, I don't know if you ever experienced that, but like you take the fish out of water and they would like put it on a table and the fish is like flapping around and like gasping for air. And they're like, this is what you're like without the Holy Spirit, right?
Without the Holy Spirit, without Jesus.
Yes. And then they would put it back in the water eventually. And like, and now looking back, you're like, oh my gosh.
Yeah.
And all the kids are thinking like, oh my gosh, this fish, like get it back into water. I remember feeling like sick to my stomach. And you're like,
right.
Really? Like, this is what we're doing? Unbelievable.
You know, and I remember one of the most traumatic things for me as a kid is when I was in first or second grade, the church decided they were going to show the, you know, that end times movie, like Thief in the Night, Distant Thunder, and something, you know, Tribulation Force or something. I don't know, some other name. Anyway, in the second movie, there is a Methodist pastor who has been left behind depicted in that movie.
Yes.
And his name is Matthew Turner.
Oh.
And I mean, everyone in the room as I'm watching this, like turns to me. Like it's just, like, I remember that so vividly. Like I remember being so frightened that one day I would have to face a guillotine. Mm-hmm. Who is, what kid is raised in a situation where they feared, like I would have nightmares about facing a guillotine and thinking that that would be one day something that I would, that could possibly happen in my story if I did not like do the right thing. Mm. And it's just, that's just one of the examples. And I'm like, I can't imagine giving my kids that story to sit with.
Right.
And that was everybody. And I know that I certainly had the personality where I felt it more deeply than a lot of kids. Like, I know that because I know that there are some people who I mean, they say they're fine. Like, they don't care. They don't think about it. I mean, fine. Like, I quote unquote, they're fine. But I know that for me, it was, I came home from school so often crying, sad, like, you know, lonely, like it was not a fun experience. And my parents knew that it wasn't a good experience, but they were so afraid of the public education. Like we were so sold on that idea of secularism, I think is the word that we would have used back then, but like secularism of the public schools. And I was afraid of the public schools too. Like, I mean, so like it was there was a catch 22 where there was no winning. Mm-hmm.
From what you've said, Matthew, you were fully in this toxic system through like 12th grade. Was there a sudden break for you after that? What happened to you after high school?
Well, let me just explain this one thing. I went to community college for 2 years. And so the year that I went away to college, I went to Belmont University. Even though Belmont had a Baptist roots, My parents did, like, they were very, very nervous about me going away to school and have 15, 20 years later suggested that it was that experience or that thing that has led me to where I so and I'm like, oh, okay, whatever.
Yes, that was it.
That did it. But it was right as I was leaving for school, my parents, along with like three or four other families, left that church. And then they went and started their own church. And there's nothing better than when five angry families start a new church. So, because they created an experience that was even more terrible than, and I mean, like, there are so many stories. I could just go into it. Like, ah.
Can you share with us a little bit about how you got where you are today?
To where I am now, you know, I went through, I say that I experimented with Calvinism in college. So I asked my, and so when my parents found out that I was like dabbling in Calvinism, it was like, you might've thought I was dabbling in witchcraft. They were so sad. They were so upset. You know, it's such a big deal. And so, but I think that for the next like 8 to 10 years, it was this walking away from fundamentalism. Like I would, you know, like I would read a book like In the Grip of Grace by Max Lucado, and it would be like life-changing. Oh my gosh, grace, like who would have thought? But like, I thank God for those kinds of books because they were little glimpses. Yeah. They were windows to an outside understanding of God that I had no idea about. Like I didn't know.
Yeah.
I didn't know about grace, all right? And so they were freeing for somebody like myself. Now, I mean, I eventually had to like recover from that concept as well, because like you, it was just basic evangelicalism that I like eventually fell into. And, you know, I think at some point, you know, like, and in addition to this, as I, you know, got out of college, I became very, my faith became very connected with my politics, of course. And, you know, I was very much Republican. I voted for Bush twice, and I was caught up in the idea of his compassionate conservatism. If you remember, that was his big ploy during his first election. And I thought, oh my gosh, conservatism, compassion, what a novel idea. So I fell hook, line, and sinker for it. And then I watched that compassion deteriorate during Katrina. Hurricane Katrina. And I watched the racial divide that was showcased during that experience, where the people in Mississippi were treated in a different way than the people in New Orleans. And like, it was a wake up thing for me, where I started to understand and realize my whiteness, and my politics changed within weeks. And so like, my politics changed before my understanding of how to make them okay with the gospel changed. Yeah. Like I didn't know what, but I changed my politics completely. And it's so, as my politics changed, so did my understanding of God. I started looking for, you know, this was back during like when the emergent church was happening in certain places of the world. And so like I got to meet people who could theologize certain things that I didn't know was possible to theologize. And the other thing was, like, I remember there being a moment where Jessica and I had gotten married and we were going to a Bible church in here in Nashville. And everyone on the way into church was handed a rock. Okay. And we were all supposed to hold on to that rock. And we were given the sermon, and, you know, and it was something about like the rocks crying out and about our praise being important, and, you know, and how it was our job to keep that rock in our hands quiet. And I remember just being dumbfounded by the stupidity of that illustration and thinking, this rock is not going to do anything. Like, this rock is a, like, don't gaslight me. I wouldn't have used that term at that point, but don't gaslight me with bullshit that it just is not really a thing. That if I don't express my praise, there is a chance that this rock I'm holding is going to do something. I was sort of just dumbfounded by it. And so like at that point, I started a blog called Jesus Needs a New PR. And I just started writing about my experiences and my understandings. And, you know, I was just a writer. I didn't have a church connected to me. I got away with saying things that other people probably wouldn't have said. And so like, you asked where I am now. I'm content. I'm content. Do I have questions? Yeah, sure. And I'm okay with the questions. I'm okay with there being several different answers. I'm okay with there not being an answer. I'm okay. I believe God is with me. But I also believe God is with a whole lot more people than I would have ever thought growing up. If I die and there's nothing, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
I'm at a place where I feel like faith is just different. Like I don't have to prove or defend or promote. I can just be. And there's a lot of power in that. You know, only in the last few years have I like really started to understand a little bit more about what faith is. I don't need the evangelical experience to engage faith. You know how you think about people as they get older? My parents are now, 80. And there's this evolving of their stories just becoming more relaxed. I remember my grandmother's like life. She was so content and so lovely and caring and compassionate and content. Like when she died, she was ready. There was a foundation or a beauty that she had sort of embraced and become okay with. And I look at my parents who have been in a conservative type of faith their entire life. And in every church they have ever been into, it has been a fight. A few years ago, they got into this mass conversation and debate with other people in their church because there was a gun found in the pulpit of the pastor where he kept a loaded gun inside the pulpit. And, in my head, I'm like, okay, get rid of him. Like that, like he should be gone. Like that's a, like what if a kid picked it up? Like all these things going through my,
oh my gosh, crazy.
You know, and my mom and dad are just, they've had this constant wrestle with every church experience. And my mom is so scared about everything she sees on the news. Everything, like if so-and-so gets voted in, oh my gosh, it's, the world is going to come to an end. I want my faith to just slowly evolve into a rest and a peace, and for me to be able to find a zen in these moments of absolute chaos and frustration. Yeah. And that's what I want to give my kids. And I can assure you, I don't do it perfectly, but I don't know if I'm doing the story right, but I do know that I try to lead with kindness, and I try to lead with compassion, and I try to lead with love, and not creating worry over every single thing. The one thing that I remember as I walked away from my upbringing in the church, as I walked away from that belief system, every single thing that I would step away from, whether it was an ideology or whether it was like a basic idea of, like when I decided I was going to be okay with drinking alcohol at a time in my life, like every step created chaos and absolute war. When I wasn't allowed to go to the movie theater as a kid. So when I went to my first movie, I was almost 20 years old, y'all. My mom wept like a baby because I had made a choice to go to the movies. And so it was every single thing that I stepped away from. It created this drama. Where's faith?
Yeah.
Where is faith in that?
Yeah.
Yeah, like where is faith? Oh my gosh, you are like so right. We'll be right back to the rest of today's podcast episode. But first, we want to give a shout out to some of our amazing and faithful Patreon supporters, Aubrey Shumway, Matthew Kohler, and Angela Crow. For just $3 a month, you can help us keep the lights on and at the same time, be part of our safe and private Patreon community, where you won't feel so alone in this changing faith and parenting journey. We hope to see you there. Now, back to the episode. So, in the middle of all that, how did it come about that you started to write children's books? Were you always a writer?
Well, my connection to writing as a kid, I was not a great student. Nobody in my childhood ever thought that I would grow up to be a New York Times writer. Like, it just it was not, that was not on the radar ever. But the one thing that I did do is I kept a notebook where I wrote rhymes. Like, I was constantly like writing a song or what in my head, or like working on a poem that I was just good at that. And so I remember Jessica, like after Adeline, our second baby was born, Jessica was like, you know what? Have you ever, like, I think you should write children's books. Like, and there was something about that connection to that. Like there was something about that. The idea of wanting to give my kids a different story that I connected to. Now, I didn't realize at the time, I think I do. I mean, I learned later that I was really writing these books for the child in me. Like, this was a healing process for me to reconnect with belief and light in a way that I never was able to connect with before. So the answer to your question, yes, this was a writing children's books started as this idea of, how can I tell my kids not only about God, but tell them in a way that they won't have to recover from? So,
yeah, a lot of times I feel like for me, I'm doing for my kids what I wish I had had myself when I was their age. Do you find when you're writing your children's books that you're actually writing to your younger self and maybe like giving yourself what you needed back then?
Absolutely. I think it was in therapy that I connected the concept of the idea that I was writing for the child in me. You know, as you start to do and become comfortable with like inner child work, you realize so much of what we do is connected to what that inner child needs and what it needed. And so I definitely connected with this concept of what the messages I put in my books is, as I thought I was writing for other kids, I, you know, was ultimately writing for myself. Y'all, like there was a moment, I've written a lot of children's books in the parking lots of grocery stores. That sounds so dumb, but there's something about being active, like being walking around, like I walk, sometimes I'll do it at a park, but usually it's at a grocery store parking lot in the emptiest part of that place. And I remember being in that parking lot and I was writing the words to When God Made You. And I got to a part in that book where it was, so be you, fully you, a show-stopping review. And these words like poured out of me, live your life in full color, every tint, every hue, discover, explore, have faith, but love more, and learn and relearn all that God made you for. And I remember stopping and I just wept. Because this was before I had come out. This was before my divorce. This was before, you know, my kids were still little. And, you know, I got to a place in my life where I never thought that I would ever have the opportunity to live my full self. Like, that was not on my radar ever. And even when I thought about it, it just induced fear. But I could dream about it for others all the time. And so I remember thinking, I may not have the opportunity. But if I can get a gay kid in a church to just see the wink, wink in these words where it says, so be you, fully you, a show-stopping review, live your life in full color, every tint, every hue, like every single word was something that I wanted to bring freedom to kids so they would not have to go through what so many of us, you know, have gone through, whether it's LGBTQ related or not. I wanted them to know that God delights in them and their full selves.
Yeah. I mean, I love that. I think you kind of hit the nail on the head with your books, especially. And then also the Reverend Mama's book, My Love God Is Everywhere, which I know you helped them a ton. But their book was the, sort of a similar way, too, I think, written in this way where it's like four kids. But even when I'm thinking about your books, like I read them more than they do. Like, I mean, I have them like all here. And when something doesn't make sense to me, I pull them out and I'm like reading, like I'm reading pieces of this for myself. And maybe that's because so many of us have lost childhoods. Like so many of us are now growing up in our 30s and 40s because we didn't have it and older, right? Because we didn't have it before. But that I think is the beauty of your words. Like you're writing them for kids and kids love and enjoy them. But as adults, there's like so much healing in hearing the things that you have to say in sort of these like simple little poetic rhymes, but they're so meaningful. And so I just love that. But I think it's cool to hear you talk about your journey to get some of that out and like what you were thinking when you did it. It's really interesting.
Yeah. Do you think that your book, When God Made You, somehow touched a place inside of you? Like you said, you were weeping, where maybe you were able to move into your full self or not yet?
No, not yet. Not yet. No, that was not. When you are raised in a situation where you have lived in fear of losing everything, if your full truth was to ever be revealed or you were to ever like lean into it, it's a constant juggle of a secret. Like you're just constantly juggling, constantly like, trying really, really hard to find the fullness in every moment. But I started to lose myself. Like I mean, Jessica has said that I may have lost my husband in all of this, but I got my best friend back. Because so much of like I had lost me. And I was so afraid because I didn't want to hurt anybody. I didn't want to hurt my kids, and I didn't want to, you know, I didn't want to hurt Jessica, and I didn't want my family to disown me, and my mom and my dad and my three sisters. And even though our relationship had long been complicated, I didn't want to be the cause of more drama, I guess. And so, working through that and starting to re-envision what that could look like. Like it just took lots of therapy and lots of bravery. It's something that when I am able to kind of like sit in that moment, I'm still surprised that I ever got to the place that I was able to do it. Honestly, you know, my new book is on this concept of belonging. And one of the things that I realized in the process of writing that book is that I didn't know what belonging was before writing that book. I'd never experienced full on true belonging. I grew up I didn't have very many friends ever. And every friend I had was really difficult. I felt like a little bit of an outsider in my own family. And then I came out of that experience, and that experience became the reason why I couldn't fit into normal situations, like because I didn't know how to disagree with people. I didn't know how to have relationships with people that had different things and for me to be okay with them being different. And so like it was just one big lesson about relating and belonging after another that I had to relearn. And it wasn't until I wrote the concept for the first couple lines where the book, where it says that you belong, you do. That's always been true. You've belonged to yourself since you were tiny and new.
Yeah.
And I belong to myself. And that idea, me embracing that, me relearning that has just bloomed into every aspect of my life. Like when you're okay with yourself, like when you are one with yourself, when you belong to me, I can be a really good dad in the most important moments. I can be a really good friend and available and present. I can walk into situations and be able to connect with people that I wouldn't ordinarily be comfortable connecting with because I am okay with me. And I grew up being constantly worried what somebody was thinking about me. I lived so much of my life paranoid about how people thought about me. Every time I got to a place where, you guys, where I would walk by a closed door meeting at my workplace, I would worry deeply that what was happening in that closed door meeting had to be about me. And not all of that is religious related, but it was birthed out of this like world, this concept of where my behavior was constantly picked apart by every single person in my church, in the circle. You can never escape it. And there were definitely closed door meetings that happened where I was the topic of discussion in school and whatever. But like this latest book was just this second awakening, if you will, to this idea of belonging. And how so many of us are just, we went through this pandemic and we're exhausted. We're lonely. We crave touch. We crave community. We crave like, and we don't necessarily know how to get it and how to process it and how to pursue it. And we think that the church gives us, or churches will often, and it doesn't matter like whether they're evangelical or progressive, they give us like these activities that they think is going to produce, you know, belonging in us or community in us. And it's, that's not it. But we have a whole bunch of people that are not okay with who they are. Mm-hmm. And so even in the process of pursuing belonging, because they don't have that belonging to themselves, it's a struggle. Anyway, I might be projecting a little bit because it's something that I've had to learn and I've had to learn over and over again. And so it has freed me, like talking about myself and, you know, and just like, I'm not worried about what y'all think about me. Like I don't. Yay. And so like, I know that that sounds simple. And I know that other people will walk into this kind of a situation there and they're like, I never did think about what the other person was worrying about with me. That wasn't me. I was constantly wondering what it was somebody else was thinking about me.
I do think that's been true for a lot of us, right? Because like, I mean, what you thought and experienced like didn't matter. Like you had to have somebody else's opinion. You had to have a pastor speaking into your life. You had to have God speaking into your life, right? Like, and who you are is separate from all of that. So like, I do think it actually probably resonates with like way more people listening than it doesn't, because that is sort of like the basis of who we are. Yeah.
I remember sitting in church. And there was a sermon, the preacher was preaching, and I was playing, I had my coat in my lap, and I was just like looking down, and I was playing with the zipper just like back and forth, quietly. The next day, the pastor came to our first and second grade class and called me out in front of all the people and said, if I ever see you playing with your coat again, I will come down and I will take that coat away from you and I will embarrass you in front of all the people. Okay. One moment, just a blip, but it represented like that one moment was just a picture of all the things, all the ways that they picked apart our stories.
Yeah. The constant barrage of, if you do this, you will not belong. That constant barrage, drip by drip by drip by drip. You won't belong to the church. You won't belong to your family. You won't belong to God. Mm-hmm. And at the end of the day, what you're finding and what you found, which is why I think it's so powerful, and we got really quiet there for a minute, when you belong to yourself, nothing, no system, no person, no group can take that away from you.
They cannot take it away from you.
Cannot.
Yep.
And that is the most beautiful thing, because then you can kind of live from that place of peace.
Yeah.
And like you said, contentment.
Right.
And there isn't the constant threat. It's like, no, 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 no. You are not allowed to take away me from me, nor can you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so the book, but what's great about the book is the book goes into this concept. And one of the things that I did not want to do is I did not want to, depending on a person's experience, sometimes we have a belonging with our parents and sometimes we don't have a belonging with that of our parents. And so I wanted, like I danced around how to connect the dots between, okay, so you belong to yourself. How do you begin to reach out and belong to other people? And so I said, you belong, you do. You'll know when it's true. You belong to the people who pour life into you. And it might be the people with whom you share history, or it might be people that encourage you to embrace every mystery. It's the people who inspire. It's the family you trust to set your passions on fire. I did not want to just say, you belong to dad, you belong to mom, you belong. Yeah. Like I wanted there to be this ownership, this autonomy for the kid to be able to stand in their own and say, it's okay if you belong to mom, but it does mom pour life into you? There are no assumptions.
That's so powerful. When can we get a hold of this thing?
March 12th, it comes out. Okay. And so, yeah.
So exciting.
So exciting. Hey, I have one other thought. As you were talking about Jessica, your ex-wife, is she somebody that you still feel like you belong to? I mean, I'm like watching you guys on social media and it feels like you co-parent so well. It's crazy. There's not a lot of divorced people out there who are really good friends, doing the co-parent thing so well, loving on their kids. Is that something you guys have chosen to do on purpose? And maybe do you think it might be born out of the place where you can actually be your full self?
Oh, absolutely. Jessica, what we have now, I've said this many times, but what we have now was something that Jessica gifted to us, because I've watched so many people go through similar stories. And the straight spouse is so hurt and so angry and so like devastated. And of course they are. Like, of course they are. Jessica says, if we're going to do this, we're going to do this different. And it took me a long time to, like, I wasn't sure I could trust the grace in it. But she has given me she just showed up. She just kept showing up, y'all. Like she is a human that does not have the religious stuff that I grew up in. She didn't have a lot of that kind of trauma in her life. And so she showed up and was a whole lot of grace in the middle of being hurt, in the middle of being sad, in the middle of like her grief process. She kept showing up and said, we're going to do it different. That was not something that I could have experienced now without her grace being there first. And so but yes.
What are the gifts that grace has given to you and your kids?
My kids get to know me.
Yeah.
They get to know me. My kids get to see their dad fully show up.
Yeah.
I mean, life's not perfect. It's not, I'm not saying that, but like there's a joy that is present now that had been diminished over years before. And I still, like, even talking about it, like, I still, like, y'all, like, when I sit and I think about that, I get to wake up this morning and I get to be me in my whole self. I have a little bit of that, like, it's Christmas. It's Christmas, because like I never thought that it would ever be a thing. And I just every once in a while I have to pinch myself to fully appreciate that I get to be who I am. And I have a really great relationship with my kids, and I have a really great relationship with my best friend and ex-wife, and the things that we put on the internet, like our everyday life. Like, I mean, I've talked to her twice already, this either via text, like she is my best friend. We talk about dating. We talk about our families. We talk about all the things, and we talk about parenting. And so Jessica's she's a really beautiful human. Mm-hmm. And like, she has done the work required to be able to give that gift to me.
Well, and I think you're a beautiful human too.
I know. I was going to say the same thing. I mean, I think being authentically yourself is one of the greatest gifts we can give our kids. And it's also like one of the hardest things to do, right? And I've been talking a lot with my own therapist about that, you know, and she has, from a more like, you know, studies based, I guess, way of thinking, has said like authenticity is so needed in a parent-child relationship.
Yeah.
And is missing in so many. And so your ability to be authentically you, because you've done that work too. Like, you've done the work to be authentically you. That was not easy.
No.
You just wake up one morning and be like, and I'm just going to be authentically me. Like, I just want to be, you know, like, I mean, you've done the work to be authentically you, and your kids see that. And they will thrive in specific ways because they have that.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it's amazing. It's really cool. It's really cool.
Do your kids love your books?
They love my books. Yeah.
Aw.
I was like, I literally was reading. I'm in the process of writing my next one. And I was reading some of it to my daughter on the way to school this morning. And she was like, oh, Dad. That's just beautiful. Like, I mean, she certainly, my 15-year-old, he certainly acknowledges what I do is, you know, and thinks it's cool. But my daughter and my youngest sort of are still in that age group where they really, really love it. So.
That's awesome. Your daughter's like middle school rock concerts give me so much life. Every time you post them, I'm just like, oh, give me more. She's got so much like confidence and like charisma and like energy. And like, she's just, it's so fun. I love watching them.
It's like literally the first time Jessica and I sat down in the audience to watch our daughter do this thing. We didn't know. I mean, we'd heard what they were going to sing. We had like, but we had no idea that our daughter had so much like this natural like thing. When she gets on a stage, she comes alive.
Yeah.
And it has been so much fun, because it's like, you know, when you see your kid's natural gift or natural thing come out, it's like some of the greatest thing you can ever experience. Like, and so watching her really just come into her own. And again, Jessica's really good in front of people. I sang my entire childhood. So like, there's certain elements, but like, to see her having not expressed that before, like with any kind of consistency, see her get up on stage and just own it. I'm like, what in the world? Like, it's wild. It's really, really wild.
Well, and how healing is that too? Somebody who hasn't had all this trauma, somebody who hasn't had to hide themselves, when it's their time to bloom, it just happens. There's like nothing stopping it.
And that's that. You're exactly right. That you're exactly right. Because I hope that what I give my kids is a presence of self. That yes, I am their parent, and there's going to be times when I have to limit something in their story in order for them to learn how to do things better. But in the process of doing that, never, my goal is to never steal away their joy, steal away their livelihood, their glory. You know, and so I'm always, always reminding them that we have to learn to be kind to each other. We have to learn to not use words that are hurtful to other people. But you can do that without having to lose a part of who you are. Mm-hmm. That spirit that's behind that, there's something to that. Mm-hmm. Embrace that spirit, but feel it. Fuel it in a different direction. Fuel it. And I was never talked to like that. Like, never. It was always
don't be you instead of be you.
Don't be. Yeah. So I'm real careful with like language and stuff. And I probably am too careful sometimes. But I think that that's a lot of us. I think that's a lot of us who have grown up in trauma where we just want to give. We really have this earnest desire to give our kids a different story than what we experienced, regardless of whether that was just family trauma or spiritual trauma or whatever. We want our kids to be fully alive. And that's what I want for my kids.
Oh my gosh, so good. And that's what you want for other people's kids too, which is so evident. I love that. So can you tell everybody where they can find you?
Awesome. I am at MatthewPaulTurner.com, Matthew Paul Turner on most social media. And you can get my books. They'll be available everywhere.
Great. Well, thank you so much. This has been awesome talking with you.
I've loved talking to y'all. Thank you so very much.
Well, that's it for this episode of the Deconstructing Mamas podcast. We love that you tuned in and hope that this gave you a little bit of grace and space for your soul to breathe.
Don't forget to catch up on any of our episodes that you missed. And remember to follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Deconstructing Mamas.
That's where you'll find all the information that you need about the podcast, as well as on our website, deconstructingmamas.com. You can also sign up for our weekly newsletter when you get there.
If you'd like to support the podcast, join our Patreon network for just $3 a month and have access to our private community with all kinds of extras. Leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts or just tell others about the show.
Thanks for listening and come back again for our next episode. We can't wait to be on the other side of your headphones.